great stuff that's happening in Atlas in terms of environmental impact and sustainability for computing. I'll give you a 15-minute timer, and it will buzz with a very funny sound so that you know when your time is up, and then we have time for questions. So yes, Zach, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Thanks very much, Sigonia. And I will do my best to run through our Atlas Computing Sustainability Studies here. On the top here, you can see a distribution of the computing that we run worldwide. It really is a global effort. And I'll tell you about some of the reasons that that's important and interesting in the talk. So, for scale, we operate something like 700,000 cores of compute worldwide, and you see peaks up to 1 million cores when we take over big chunks of high-performance computing systems. And we have something like an exabyte of data between disk and tape at the moment. That's a combination of grid sites that we talked about earlier in the session and high-performance computers, those used to be called supercomputers, cloud computing, and some volunteer computing. And again, those peaks are mostly driven by those high-performance computing centers where we're users, but certainly not the reason for existence of the data centers. When we look forward to the future, to the HLHC, those resources are going to grow. So we know by the time the HLHC starts up in sort of 2030-ish now, we're going to need a factor of 3 to 5 more compute, disk, and tape. And by the end of data taking in 2041, the end of the collaboration, we'll need another factor of 2. So we're talking about an order of magnitude growth, which means we have a nice lever arm to adjust. If we can improve things, we can pull down the projected carbon cost of those resources. In general, we make resource requests 12 to 18 months in advance. So in year, Jevons paradox applies where you make something faster and we just do more of it. Over the course of 1 to 2 to 3 years, there is opportunity for reduction of resources through optimization. And we have seen that where we've made a workflow faster, we've made some data smaller, and therefore, 2 years out, 3 years out, we've requested fewer resources and had some savings there. So obviously, if we can pull down these lever arms, then we'll reduce the carbon cost of the experiment. But there are a lot of other things that we can do as well. So one simple thing is to just build awareness in the collaboration of what's going on. Every user, when they run a job on the distributed computing system, gets an email like this when it's done. And you notice down here, there's an estimated carbon footprint for the task section, which gives them a link to what it means and how it's calculated and so on. This includes now an average carbon footprint, averaged worldwide, for the tasks that they've run. And we keep internally the information about the actual carbon footprint for that task in that location for the grid carbon intensity there. We provide a worldwide average for a few reasons. One is there are a lot of data centers. We don't control them. We don't have all the information about all of them. We don't know where there are solar panels yet. So we're trying to get that information until we know we shouldn't charge sites extra. Second thing is CPU doesn't sit idle. So if a user moves a job from Poland to Norway, we'll put a different job on the site in Poland. We won't just let the CPU sit idle. So moving jobs around doesn't actually save carbon. The third reason, and this is something that you'll hear me say a few times, if all the users take action and everyone pushes their work to Norway, the Norwegian data center will get absolutely hammered. The disks will burn out faster. The network will be hammered, and the jobs will become less efficient. And we'll still be running the data centers elsewhere. So actually, recommending that they all do that would cost us in carbon terms. It would be a negative solution. So there are a lot of cases like this where if you sort of take too myopic a view, you can make a recommendation that's harmful globally. The last reason is it's a nice correlation. You want to say if somebody makes their code faster, that they have a lower carbon footprint. And if you do a global average, that correlation's stronger. It's, of course, not intended to shame anybody. We just want to make them aware of what's going on. And we also do this now for production. So you can see here's a production that costs 2 tons of carbon, about 130 of which was failed jobs. That's pretty typical. 5-6% failures is about right for our grid productions. We also have started to build awareness early on in tutorials. So there's this Atlas Analysis tutorial, and we teach folks how to run a failing job and then diagnose what happened, and then to look at the carbon impact of that failing job. We find people are not familiar with how this all works, and we found cases in the wild where users have retried jobs hundreds of times, and they just keep failing around the world, hundreds of times. So this seems like an education issue. Now we just need to make people more aware of how to fix things and what goes wrong. Then there are a bunch of things that we can do in terms of policies that impact our carbon footprint. I really like these because, building a new data center, buying new hardware takes years to replace old hardware. If you change a policy, if you change what you store, that's almost instant in terms of its carbon impact. So these are really nice things to be able to get after. Mostly historically, they've been thought of in financial terms. For things like the data carousel, which is a system by which we use tape more than disk and move data actively on and off of tape, the idea was we'd save cash because tape is cheaper than disk. We also save carbon because, in carbon terms, tape is cheaper than disk. So this is a case where there's a nice synergy. Everything's pointing in the same direction. Obviously, there are other places where they point in opposite directions, and we have to justify things somehow. Another nice example is data reproduction. So if a user says, "I want to save this data just in case I need it," do I save it or do I delete it? And our most recent math says if they request it less than about 15% of the time, we should just delete it and reproduce it on demand. And the request rate is about 25% right now, give or take. So right now, we're better off keeping it. That balance could change in the future such that it's actually better for us to delete the data and then reproduce it if they ask. The last obvious policy is to use what we have. So we talked earlier today about the trigger farms for several experiments. Those got built. We paid the embodied carbon. We paid the carbon for the Tier Zero center. Those are all for operation of the LHC. The LHC doesn't operate year round. So when it's not on, we need to use that compute as best we can to make sure that we amortize the embodied carbon over more compute. A few other things we're looking into are things like waste, lost, and unused data, right? It's okay, in my opinion, if we use carbon for science. It's not okay if we waste carbon while doing science, right? So this was a look at when we produce data that no one ever looks at. And you see, like a year ago, some data that were produced that were never looked at. Most of these things turn out to be two inclusive patterns. Somebody asks for all the Monte Carlo. They don't really need all the Monte Carlo. Or they ask for a big production, check a few files, find a bug, and then the rest of the production just goes ahead and they don't kill it off fast enough, right? So these sorts of things cost us, and we're trying to get better. We're, of course, trying to improve our CPU over wall efficiency. You can see the trend over the last few years. It's upward. It's slow, but it's upward. It's hard to get higher than 90% efficiency in a lot of these cases. And there's a constant effort to sort of reduce the serial portions of many core, multi-core jobs as well. We also have automated systems to take sites offline when they have problems. So there's a significant potential savings when a site that starts failing can be taken offline and we don't have lots of failing jobs there. We're also preparing to release a significant amount of our event generation output as open data. So this would be a sort of service to the community. It's good scientifically. That's great. It's hard because we have to document everything that we produced publicly. Okay, that documentation is good for us, so maybe that's okay. We're going to release something like 10 million CPU hours of event generation. And now we have to ask a really interesting question that we'll have to come back to in about a year to see what the answer is. One is, does the community pick it up at all? Like, do they actually use it? A second is, does it actually reduce the amount of event generation that is run in the community? Right? It's not obvious that people will necessarily use ours and not generate their own, or won't generate more and use ours. And the third is, does it actually result in a carbon savings? Or in reality, do people use the same or even more carbon because they're able to run over larger numbers of events? So we'll have to see what, in carbon terms, this does. It might be different from the answer to what scientifically it does. So hopefully I'll come back in a year and tell you more. We've also looked into job failures quite a bit. we found out it's very important to decorrelate issues to avoid victim blaming, right? So we have this Tier Zero center at CERN. It's very efficient. The failures are quite rare. That's because it runs very well-controlled jobs. We have other data centers that have kind of unique resources where there are very high failure rates, and we expect fairly high failure rates. So we've tried to build this sort of expected failure rate based on worldwide failures, and then compare sites based on their observed and expected failure rates, and then look for cases where the observed rate is way different from the expectation, either above or below. And that's where we want to dig in to see what's going on, not just because there's a high failure rate, but because there's a higher than expected failure rate. So we're starting to get into this, and also starting to get into automatic retry policies. So a job runs on the grid, it fails, and we have an automated system by which we say, well, this failed, let's try it again somewhere else. Or, well, this failed, it was probably transient, let's just go again, and it might succeed next time. And obviously, if you get that wrong, you end up retrying a bunch of jobs that are just going to fail over and over again, and you should stop. So we need to constantly re-examine these sorts of policies. We've talked a lot in this workshop about software development for sustainability. It goes without saying we should continue to improve our software. One thing that's worth pointing out is it's possible to run CPUs at lower frequency to improve their performance per watt. So this is a nice little plot of the frequency of the CPU against the performance per watt. So actually, if you lower the frequency of the CPU, you get better performance per watt. If you care only about power, that's clearly a good idea, right? If you have to deliver a certain number of HEP score, say, then you might have to buy more CPUs in order to provide that much power. So you have to balance embodied and operational carbon in order to get that working point right. We've also been working on checkpointing. That's the ability to stop a job, write its state to disk, and then read it off of disk and start exactly where you left off to see if we can do a better job during outages, brownouts, regular downtime, that sort of thing. In the future, we're also thinking about this sort of situation where this is a projection to 2035 of German power, and there are periods where there's a huge amount of renewable energy. So if we can take a data center, run it when there's a ton of renewables, and then basically turn it off when the renewables are gone at night, and then turn it back on when the load is lower than the demand, the renewables are higher than the demand, we might be able to actually overall save quite a lot of carbon and maybe even make our computing largely more neutral. I mentioned validation, that we need to improve the production of buggy samples and avoid that as much as possible. That's another ongoing effort. Sustainability is not an Atlas problem or an LHC problem. So we've had a lot of success talking to other folks about what sorts of things we can do. There's a little list of folks we've collaborated with. The idea isn't to duplicate anything that they're doing. It's to do our best to share data work. And in case conclusions are workload dependent, like that frequency set point I showed you, that's workload dependent. It's not the same for Atlas as it is for Google. We need to know what the answer is for Atlas workloads. So these sorts of things help us out a lot. Here's a little example of some of the studies that we've collaborated on. So, improving the packing of jobs in the batch system. CERN had a great system called BEER, which runs compute on storage elements. They realized CPU is over-provisioned on storage, so let's run compute on it. We just introduced low-memory jobs to allow better packing of production into a batch system. This is like a 15-year-old problem that resulted in a lot of idle CPU that we've finally gotten a solution to. You can schedule storage background tasks at low carbon times and save a lot of carbon, it turns out. So these are things like data reindexing and error correction that need to happen on a big storage system, and you just schedule them in a better way. Build a new data center. They amortize over 5 to 10 years. So almost certainly you will want to build a new data center if you can make any significant improvement in PUE. Run the system hot. You don't lose any performance. The hardware lifetime isn't affected. Run the system hot. Run water cooling if you can. Reuse your waste heat if you can. These are all things that Atlas sites have been working on and trying to improve. We're doing our best to build a more complete model of the carbon footprint for Atlas Computing. You heard earlier today that's hard. We're doing our best. Hopefully, we'll get there. It is clear that limited models and limited information risk harmful recommendations, which is something we want to avoid. We're trying to make folks more aware of the environment. The goal here is to make recommendations towards a more sustainable computing model as we approach the HLHC. Since I'm out of time, I'll just mention my two favorite examples of that. Dramatic music. One is GPU usage. So we talked about GPU usage a lot earlier. There's a payoff point where I've bought a GPU and I've paid for it in embodied carbon terms, but I'm not running it enough to make it worthwhile. And rough calculations say 30 to 60% is the magic number. It's maybe closer to 60% in the future that if I'm not putting at least that average load on a GPU, I should have just bought CPU. There are a lot of other questions that we can worry about. We're also closely watching extrapolations that affect these recommendations, like the decarbonization of the power grid, which makes embodied carbon more important than operational carbon and changes to processors. If you want to read more about anything I just said, we just yesterday had a paper hit archive with all of these studies and more. So happy reading. Thanks.
Thanks, Zach, for this really amazing talk. Are there any questions for Zach? I don't. Ah, okay, Greg, go ahead.
I didn't quite understand your comment that running the processors hot doesn't affect or degrade their lifetime. Why do you say that?
So processors generally come with a range that they're happy to run in, and it's wider than you might think. And indeed, surely if you run them well above that recommended range, you're going to get into problems. But what we found was several data centers, in the particular case of this study, it was Brookhaven, tended to run something like 15 to 20 degrees below the top of the recommended range. And actually, they could just run closer to the top of the recommended range. And there's no indication we can find in any literature that that causes any problems for the lifetime, as long as you're within
Okay.
the recommended range.
Do these processors presumably have operating systems in them that slow the clock speed down if they get too close to the limit, right?
That's what we were worried about and why we checked the performance as a function of those fan speeds in this case, which is a proxy for temperature set points, and didn't find any significant issue.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Because we're on this slide, I had a question of my own. So, on your point of building a new data center, of course, that costs money, and the funding agencies are not always happy to give that money. So, is there some kind of discussions where Atlas is actively suggesting to the funding agencies that data centers should be refurbished? Or how does this work?
What we're able to concretely say is here's some easy math you can do to see if in operational terms, operational carbon terms, this will pay off. We can also say here's some easy math you can do to see if in power consumption terms, in terms of your electricity bill, this will pay off. And in some cases, you can make those two arguments together and they'll buy it and say, okay, yeah, actually, after 5 years, I'll be saving money. So this is worth doing. It also depends on the location. So in Norway, don't build a new data center. The power is too green. In Poland, definitely build a new data center and put solar panels on the roof, right? So we're trying not to make any blanket recommendations, but to give people the tools they need or a little equation that they can fill in some numbers in to say, oh, yeah, this totally makes sense for us and we should approach our funding agency about it.
Perfect. Hopefully it works out in the long run.
Hope so.
Right. So do we have any last pressing questions for Zach? Otherwise, we can also move the discussions to the Mattermost channel. If not, then let's thank Zach.